Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaskan Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. This show, we continue a summer series saluting women and men who helped shape the University of Alaska Fairbanks. This episode, one of Alaska's own, shares why she returned to UAF.
I did a complete matrix of, you know, pros and cons, you know, and I determined that I was going to stay in California because that was the right thing. And so the man who eventually became my major professor called me on the phone to ask whether I was coming or not, and I found myself saying, sure.
UAF student, professor, and dean, Joan Braddock, spent her professional life in Alaska research, including the fallout of the Exxon Valdez oil spill.
We mostly avoided the worst of the zoo. I mean, there were so many projects going on that were just kind of craziness.
I hope you'll stick around. This summer on Northern Soundings, I'm running a series of recorded interviews I've had with retired University of Alaska Fairbanks scholars, researchers, and leaders. Our discussions take place live every Monday night in the Murray Auditorium on the UAF campus in a series called Down Memory Lane. It's hosted by UAF Summer Sessions. Last week, I got to spend time with a woman who was born in Fairbanks and received her higher education at UAF. Dr. Joan Braddock has not only distinguished herself as an undergraduate student, earning the Druska Carr Scheibel Memorial Award as an outstanding biological science major, but she was urged to return to the school to do her graduate work. Against the odds, she was also appointed to join the faculty after earning her Ph.D. Almost immediately, she was plunged into research on the consequences of the Exxon Valdez oil spill on microbial life. Later, she was tapped to serve leadership positions at the school, including department chair, associate director of the Institute of Arctic Biology, dean of the College of Natural Science and Mathematics, and interim dean of the School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. Even after retirement, she was asked to serve as interim director at UA Press, a part-time job that lasted 6 years. When we began our conversation, I asked Joan if it was true her parents lived in Minto when she was born.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, the doctor had told my mom that the midwives in Minto were fabulous and that if there was any question about coming into town to the hospital to have me, that we should go ahead and stay in Minto. But as it turned out, my dad flew a small airplane, so we did fly in. So technically, I was born in Fairbanks, but the first 3.5 years of my life were out in Minto.
Do you have any memories of the village?
Not too much. You know, my dad took fabulous footage, 16mm movies of the village, and that's actually at the library here at UAF. You can access that. And so it's, you know, when you're that young, a lot of what you remember is do you really remember it, or do you remember just seeing the pictures? But I will say one family lore is that everything from my perspective when I was a little girl came from the NC company in Nenana, which is where my dad would go to shop. He had the little plane and he would fly to Nenana and go get things. So the family lore has it that one day I asked him to get me a Big Brother for when he was at the NC company.
They were on sale.
Yeah. Found out they were out apparently because I didn't get one.
Well, now, how did your family come to be living in Minto?
My dad came up. He has a lot of, his life is quite the amazing story, but to make a long story short, he came up in the 30s and to make money in gold mining out in Nome, and eventually he started teaching school in rural Alaska, having taught in King Cove at King Island, and eventually he ended up at Minto teaching, so he was the teacher, the school teacher there.
Now, Minto, Fairbanks, Juneau, they're all different communities.
Yeah.
Do you think having experienced these various places informed you at all?
I suspect some. I mean, certainly growing up in Alaska, when I'd leave, I'd appreciate how the natural world here, the beauty. So I suspect that probably informed and partly led me to biology, but that actually probably wasn't the main driving factor. My memories, you know, really of all those places, because well, I spent most of my childhood in Fairbanks, actually, school years through sixth grade, and then we through junior high in Juneau, and then moved to Portland, Oregon in high school. But, you know, I kind of remember kids' stuff mainly.
Yeah. Were you here for the 67 flood?
We were, but we weren't living here anymore. We had just moved to Juneau and had come back up to visit. And actually, a woman in the audience here, we were staying with her in her parents' house down on 9th Avenue. And for a kid, the 67 flood was just built-in entertainment. I just thought people running out to tie down their Volkswagens so they wouldn't float away, and the boats coming down the road and all were just there to entertain us. So I wasn't really appreciating the seriousness of what it was doing to people's houses and all that. But yeah, we were here for the flood.
You mentioned, you touched on this, but do you think your early years in Alaska in some way informed your decision to go into biology?
You know, actually what really did that was TV doctors.
Kildare,
oh, man,
Casey.
Dr. Kildare, yeah, absolutely. And it was so glamorous too. And I know I was always going to be a physician, a medical physician. You know, even when I came back to go to school in biology, that was always my career goal. And I'll probably touch on later how I got derailed from that. That was really, actually, I think it was TV doctors. I figured out since later in life that probably some of those positions aren't quite as glamorous as on TV, although a good profession that I probably would have enjoyed as well, but life takes you some different paths sometimes.
Well, you, as you mentioned, we're outside. Why did you decide to come back to UAF?
Yeah, I really missed Alaska. I've left Alaska several times in my life, and I could never really leave. So we had moved to Portland, Oregon, and I went to high school there. And all I wanted to do when I applied for college was come back to Alaska. So just that Alaska bit is just ingrained real deep, I guess.
I imagine so. Well, what was the campus like when you were a student? Who was here, and what was life like?
Well, actually, who was here was Terrence and Dermot. They're almost the same age as me and some other folks. Anyway, it was, it was really, really a good place. The Biology and Wildlife Department, well, I'm not exactly sure what it was called at that point, but Biological Sciences Department or something, whatever it was called at the time, was really, really good. I mean, the classes were small, the professors were fabulous. And that's probably, I think that's really still true, one of the strengths that UAF has to offer today. There were, I lived in Wickersham at first, and there was the dorm life. And I mean, I do remember academics because I was a pretty studious kid, but I also learned how to party. There were lots of big parties at the
You see, I didn't have to take
dorms.
Any classes on that. That just came naturally to me. It's nice to know you applied yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, that was kind of the picture of how things were, I guess.
Well, you were awarded as an outstanding student, so that sounds right. But what about microbiology? What was it about that?
Yeah, okay. Well, that is a good story. So the person that really influenced me, and Ron's nodding his head because he, of course, worked with her as well, was Carol Feist, who was the microbiology professor. I just loved that class. I mean, she was a really fabulous teacher, but I just loved it. And I think, you know, it kind of was a natural because up until that point, I was still thinking I was maybe going to go into medicine. So there's the big health, part of microbiology. But I really loved that class, and I loved her as a teacher. And I ended up working for her in the winter just cleaning dishware and stuff like that. But she was a huge influence in my life, just a huge mentor. I really looked up to her, and it was a lot because of her and how much I liked that class that I continued on with microbiology in my life.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, Vera Alexander was here. Were there a lot of women scientists and academics here when you were studying?
Not that many, just a few.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Actually, there was even less in the department when I became faculty, but we may touch on that later. I was kind of it for a while.
Wow, okay, yeah, I'd love to touch. But let me kind of go, because you, after you finished, you graduated, you went into the pharmaceutical industry. Was this, again, that medical track you were aiming for?
You know, I'd like to say my life was super well planned out. And in fact, one time somebody asked me if I would consider being a graduation speaker at a high school, and it didn't happen. But I thought, well, what would I say? And I think what I would have told them after living my life the way I have is that, you know, it's great if you have your life all sketched out and you know exactly what you want to do and stuff. But you know what? Sometimes you just need to be open to opportunity. Or if you just don't have everything planned out to a T, don't worry about it so much. There's a lot of pressure, you know, to plan everything out. And my life's probably a great example of an unplanned life that worked out really well, despite my bad planning, probably. I've been really lucky. The reason that that happened really was one of my several attempts to escape Alaska. So I graduated from, I missed Alaska so much. I graduated from college and then, like, I got to get out of this place, right? So I left for California. And I had a girlfriend in California. And I looked and looked and looked and looked for jobs, and this was a job that I was qualified for, and I took it, and I actually really liked it. In fact, I did come back up, as you mentioned in the introduction, to do a master's and a degree, and I sat down, a friend of mine had called and said, well, you know, there's a professor here at UAF who's looking for a graduate student. Have you thought about coming back to graduate school? And I really wasn't. I was pretty happy working. The job was good. I liked the people I worked with. I thought I had some future there. And so I sat down with a girlfriend down there, and I did a complete matrix of, you know, pros and cons, you know. And I determined that I was going to stay in California because that was the right thing. And so the man who eventually became my major professor called me on the phone to ask whether I was coming or not, and I found myself saying, sure. So I ended up coming back to Alaska for my master's degree, and that was microbiology too, so that there was sort of a draw because of the project.
And I was interested to see the title. I don't claim to understand everything about what your research was in, but it seemed to be associated with mines and arsenic. Is that right?
Yeah. So Ed Brown, who used to be here at UAF, a few people might remember him. He was in the Institute of Water Resources, and it's what's morphed into Water and Environmental Research Center. But yes, he had a project going because he was looking at, when you have mining, there is a bacteria that's often found associated with the runoff from mines that, on the more positive side, it can be used positively to help with leaching out metals from in the mining process. It can be used positively to help leach out metals because the acid it produces leaches out metals from the mineral. But it also, on the negative side, it's what causes something called acid mine drainage. And he was curious whether some of those processes occurred in Alaska because they were really well known outside in other places. And since arsenic is associated a lot with the pyrites in Alaska, and there are some places that have arsenic water contamination issues, he wondered if there was a connection between all of that. And so the research was pretty applied, which I found later in my life was a theme for me. The projects I liked were the ones that were more applied. My project really had been to try to see if that microorganism, which, well, be technical just for a minute, so just doze off for a second if you don't understand what I'm saying. But there are some microorganisms that can oxidize metals and in the process fix carbon dioxide, sort of like a plant fixes carbon dioxide using the sunlight for the energy source. Well, there's some organisms that can do that, and the organisms in this acid mine drainage thing, which is now Acidothiobacillus, I think, which then was Thiobacillus ferrooxidans, can do that oxidation of iron. But we were interested to see if it could oxidize arsenic, because that's also enough energy from that oxidation, and that would have been kind of cool because it wouldn't have been ever described before. And I wasn't really able to do that in the laboratory stuff we did, but later on somebody else did find a strain that could use arsenic as an energy source. Well, anyway, that's probably more that anybody wanted to know about that.
No, but it's sort of interesting. I mean, it's applied, and as we'll talk about the Exxon Valdez oil spill here in a bit, but I'm interested. Would you go out and collect these specimens, bring them back to the lab, analyze them? Is Is that kind of how that would work?
We did look for places where there was mine runoff, and lots of places we didn't find any evidence of acid mine drainage, I might add. But we did one really cool thing that Ed arranged was we did a survey on the Yukon River and stopped at a whole lot of streams all the way from Canada. It was really a cool trip.
Oh, I'll bet.
And really the only place we found any sort of runoff was from tailing piles that were pretty contained situations. It was an interesting project.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with Dr. Joan Braddock, former UAF administrator, researcher, and student at UAF. When we return from the break, the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with Dr. Joan Braddock. She not only received her undergraduate degree at UAF, but her master's and doctorate as well. While her master's research focused on arsenic at mining sites, her PhD work was maritime-based. Let's return to our conversation.
You got your doctorate in oceanography. How did you make that leap over there?
Well, actually, it's a little deceptive because my PhD thesis, which was much more esoteric and less applied, and honestly, probably the only person who has a PhD who will ever say that they didn't really like their PhD project very much. I did it. I got far enough. I got the degree, and I left that all behind. It wasn't really oceanography. It actually wasn't really oceanography. It was a pretty laboratory-based study. At the time, limnology and oceanography were, you know, all under the umbrella of oceanography, so the degree was in oceanography. So I took courses. I went out. I like to go out and do field research as a volunteer for people when I could, which one wonders why, because I get really seasick. But I always
And I hear the Alpha Helix, it wasn't a great ship for that.
Yeah, no, I've had a barfing good time, but that's probably not the nicest way to put it.
We can bleep that out.
Yeah. Yes, I was out on the Alpha. I was even on the Anaconda quite a few times, and actually the ride on the Alpha Helix was an improvement. Absolutely, the Anaconda was a real tub.
Well, before we actually get to your work as a professor, that transition is kind of interesting because, A, I don't think every researcher makes for a great classroom teacher or professor for students, but that wasn't a problem. You were acknowledged as a great teacher. But also, I thought it was kind of traditional when an institution gives you your PhD, you're sort of expected to leave the nest and fly, you know, born free. So how did you make that transition into faculty, Joan?
Well, this was another step in my life where luck played a great part. So I got my PhD. I was getting my PhD the year the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which is sort of part of the story. But also, I think maybe it was the year before that my wonderful mentor and good friend, Carol Feist, passed away of a brain tumor at age 50, which, you know, when you're young, you think is not that, you think, oh, no. I mean, I didn't think she was old, but I didn't. She seems so young now. You think about age 50, right, you know? So her position was open. So they had a recruitment that, you know, shortly thereafter to fill that position, and it was an unsuccessful recruitment. So the next year, I had then gotten my PhD, and I had a bunch of research money from Exxon Valdez stuff, because there weren't so many microbiologists in the state to call on to do things. So Ed Brown, who was my PhD advisor, had gotten the call from both Exxon, interestingly enough, and from the state. So in our lab, we were doing research, you know, for part of the litigation process. And in the other part of the lab, we were working with scientists from Exxon on some of the bioremediation studies. So it was a little bit of an interesting path there. But Ed was still here, and I was working on those projects with him. And so I did apply that year, and there were four candidates, and I got to know the search committee chair later fairly well, and he said, really, we added you as the fourth candidate because you really, you know, because it would have been good experience for you to do the interview process, but, you know, everybody knows we don't hire somebody, especially in my case, who'd gotten 3 degrees here. That was really not... I've never told a student to do this. I mean, I've really never suggested to a student that this was a good idea for a variety of reasons, but it just worked out, right? But, you know, it just kind of turned out the pool. There was, you know, just sort of some issues with all the candidates. And, you know, I guess I just put my best foot forward and things worked out.
Well, all right. Before we talk about then your specific academic career, I do want to step back and talk about microbiology more broadly, because it strikes a layperson like me. I see books come out all the time and all sorts of research that the robustness of microorganism is tremendously great. I mean, these deep sea vents with energy regimes that are different than the photosynthesis that we might be more useful to. And also, their importance is growing. So, what was the field like when you started your professional career?
I mean, there have been a lot of changes. I mean, two things you allude to there happened while I was a student. The discovery of the deep sea vents, for sure. Also, a huge one was the three domains of life was, you know, discovered about that time while I was a student, which is, of which all three, I might add, have microorganisms in them. So there's two are strictly microorganisms, bacteria, archaea, and then eukaryotes. So that was really a big different understanding of life, really. And then I think probably the really big one during my career was molecular techniques, being able to PCR, now being able to sequence an entire genome of a bacteria in short order. Those things have really provided tools that weren't, I mean, there's knowledge that wasn't there, but also really tools that are incredible that weren't there. We had to look at problems. The person who took the position that I vacated when I became dean actually worked on some of her research overlaps a lot with the kinds of research questions I asked, and the tools that she has at her disposal to answer those questions are really different, with being able to quantify particular hydrocarbon degradation genes in the environment and being able to look more at some of what the organisms are, although thus saying, I think I read recently that it's estimated that we've only really identified like 1% of all archaea bacteria. So there's 99% of the world of microorganisms out there that we haven't really identified yet. So obviously there's lots to know. And there's still, you know, a lot of processes like climate change and stuff, you know, have been looked at by the process. You know, so you measure what's going on, but you're not really worrying too much about exactly how it's going on. Mm-hmm. And some of these techniques have allowed you to kind of look into the black box a little bit more and get a little better feel for who's doing it. People like to name things. I know during the oil spill, I didn't care so much about. You know, people would want, what are the names of the bacteria that are degrading oil? Well, you know, to me it sort of didn't matter, because for one thing, we can't really answer that question in any satisfying way. So to me, it was more a matter of, is the process occurring, you know? But people really do like to name things, because people always ask that question.
It's kind of like planting the flag, right?
You know, yeah, exactly. Like,
well, let's then go to that, because of course that was, you know, catastrophic for the environment, but also, I'm sure a lot of research opportunities arose from that spill. And so talk a little bit about the research that you did around the Exxon Valdez.
Well, as I mentioned a minute ago, we worked with the state to document things like populations of microorganisms, hydrocarbon degrading microorganisms in spill areas, and what their activity was, again, using really primitive techniques based on, we were still back in the day using culture techniques, which are pretty estimates at best. So that was kind of the information we were collecting on that end. And then it was really kind of interesting because we also did work with Exxon on, you know, the effectiveness of some of the bioremediation agents. And that was really pretty interesting, you know, just to have those kind of two things going on. They were interesting studies, although I'll have to say I'm not, in that particular application, I never was a real believer that the bioremediation was the end all for two reasons. One is because those waters that are washing over those beaches, at least for a good part of the season, are not that nutrient depleted. So the whole idea of bioremediation, usually it's nutrient additions, and is a huge part of that, or adding bugs, as people like to say, all of which are pretty ineffective in some cases. I mean, you have proof that in that environment you need the nutrients, for example, and in that particular circumstance, I was never convinced that that was the case. The data really didn't
bear that out
that much, or that the enhancement was pretty limited. I mean, the other big thing too was that people always believed that the cold, that microbial things wouldn't happen because it was way too cold. Well, in the first place, Prince William Sound really isn't that cold. You know what I mean? We're not talking Arctic Alaska. So that's really the first thing. But people just think Alaska and immediately think cold, you know. So in fact, it was really interesting during the Valdez oil spill, the misconceptions. Like some of our papers, people would say, well, why don't you just go out on the beach and take a core? It's like most of these shorelines, there's no way on earth there'd be rocks, and you know, you couldn't go out with a little core and take a core sample on most of the shorelines. I mean, there's some places maybe you could. Or actually, one of my favorite victories in a paper, it was one of the Exxon Valdez papers, was we had a November cruise. So I think we'd had a couple cruises in the summer because we collected onshore and offshore samples during the oil spill for several years, actually. And I wrote up a paper, and I kept referring to the November cruise as the winter cruise or the winter samples. And one of the reviewers snarkily said, and truthfully, honestly, he was right, said, well, November's not winter. And I actually convinced the editor to allow me, because in Alaska, in Prince William Sound, November was pretty darn wintry. I actually defined November as winter in the methods, and he allowed me to use the word winter in the paper. That was one of my small victories. Yeah, you got, well, you know, sometimes when you're sitting in your office 12 hours a day, you gotta get your jollies where you can, right?
Well, you know, Joan, I remember that time, and you'd see these pictures, and it seemed like a total zoo.
Yeah.
Would it be difficult to go out and gather the data that you needed?
Yeah, we mostly avoided the worst of the zoo because we kind of had our own separate thing going. I also, it was kind of when I kind of realized something strange about human psychology, because a lot of the stuff we did didn't cost that much on a relative scale. I mean, there were so many projects going on that were just kind of craziness. And I mean, some of the consultant reports were really nuts that I would read. There was some microbiology that was done by a consultant, and I'm reading the report, and it's just crazy stuff. Like, they're naming the organisms. Remember, everybody wants to know what the organisms are, and so a consultant went out and named all these organisms, and there's one of them was like Staphylococcus aureus from the beach, and I'm like, no, that was from the hands of the person. Yeah. You know, it's a human skin contaminant. So there was just a lot of money spent on some kind of crazy things, but you know, we always really had you know, pretty streamlined our projects and tried to make them really cost effective and all that stuff. And that's when I learned that there's this weird psychology that if you don't charge enough for something, sometimes people don't value it as much. And sometimes I thought, you know, people didn't value some of the things we were saying just because it didn't cost enough. So then I wondered if I should incorporate that into future plans.
So would, and then finally, before I, because we have so much to cover, but on a study such as that, there must be long-term follow-ups on much of this, isn't there?
Yes, and there was for a while. I mean, our stuff got cut off sooner than some other things because at some point, really, you know, you really do still care about the impacts for a longer period of time on fisheries and things like that. But I mean, after a few years, what can you say? But there's still microorganisms that degrade oil there because there's still some oil present. You know, some of the things we were doing became somewhat uninteresting after a while. So there was a natural cutoff. And that was actually okay with me because I was really ready to move on to other types of things. But the Exxon Valdez, I was very, again, luck. I've been lucky. My whole life I've been lucky. You know, it really set me up and got me started on. And we had projects and I got my lab started. And then that led to people coming, you know, or me being a person who could offer services for other applications. And I did a lot of work up with the U.S. Geological Survey up in Utqiagvik at the NARL, the former naval site up there, where they had had big fuel storage tanks. So that, you know, anytime over years and years and years, especially in the Arctic, when you have big fuel storage tanks, you're going to have spills because it's just going to happen. And they had been there for many years. And so they were trying to transfer that land over to the Native Corporation, and there had to be cleanup to complete that process. And so we did a whole bunch of research up there, and that was really applied. And I loved that work because at the end of the day, the stuff we did, they used in a bioremediation plan, ultimately, that cleaned up fuel that had been, diesel fuel that had been persisting in it wasn't really soil, it was gravel pads for like 45 years. And they actually, by using the method we came up with, were able to clean it up to cleanup levels. And that was always a very rewarding moment in my career.
I'm sure. Yeah. Well, with all the abilities now, and it's certainly advancing quickly with genetic editing and whatnot, do you think there's going to be a time in bioremediation where you have designer microbes that can handle specific tasks for remediation?
Well, you know, I hesitate to be absolute about that because I think there's some things we can't even imagine. But I will say this. It's complicated. You can have the best superbug in the world, but you throw it out in the environment and it's got to compete. Mm. And that was a huge thing. Lots of people like to come up with, oh gosh, the oil spill eater product and some of these really funny products.
Yeah, I bought some of that for my septic system.
Yeah, there's all these products. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of times, if you have the superbug that in the lab can do all this, you know, degrade every hydrocarbon you can think of, and you throw it out in the environment, now they have to compete in the cold and nutrient stress and, you know, the organisms that are there that actually know how to live in that environment. And a lot of times I think those fancy products become a food source for the organisms that are there and really, and then you can actually stall out the degradation of the oil products because there's a tastier food source. And so I think there is potential certainly for some of the new techniques that we have to help with problems like cleanup of sites and stuff, but it probably won't just be creating a superbug and dumping it on the site. Well, unless we can create the superbug that's got all those, adaptive features in it.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. And if you're just joining us, I'm airing a public conversation I recorded last week with Dr. Joan Braddock, former professor and dean at UAF. After this break, we'll hear about solving problems as an administrator.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Northern Soundings. This summer, I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with former Dean and Professor Dr. Joan Braddock. Let's return to our conversation.
You also served in many leadership roles at the university. Now, I think for a lot of faculty, they're tasked on occasion to serve on a committee or even be chair for their department. And for some, it's okay. And for others, they really take to it. It seemed like you took to it.
I did, but I that kind of surprised me, actually. So I was asked to be department chair, kind of, you know, rotates around. And it's like, I did it last
week. Like the plague, you know? Right?
Yeah, exactly. And I agreed to do it. And then actually, I think the dean at the time, there was actually a little money back in the day, sent me to a kind of a workshop for new department chairs, and which was really good, actually. But I remembered one of the comments was one of the people said, how many people in the audience, this was the facilitator at this workshop, became department chair because you were afraid of who else might become department chair, like every hand goes up. You know? So anyway, yes, I did a round as department chair of biology and wildlife. And then actually I went on sabbatical. And it was when I came back, they needed somebody to fill in as interim dean for what was actually science, engineering, and mathematics at the time. So the non-mining and petroleum engineering departments were combined with science at that time. Mm. So I served, and I was asked to do that, and I decided to go for it, and I found out I actually really liked it.
I have to, just as an aside, say so many people I've interviewed have so many different renamed and reshuffled departments that it's often hard to keep track which school or which college had which departments in it, you know, because they seem to migrate back and forth. And let me ask you, and just between us, ignore them.
Oh, okay.
Is there a rhyme or reason to that? I mean, is there some overall plan that someone says, you know what, that should not be there, that should be in that school?
Well, that's a good question.
I don't want to put you on the spot, you don't have to answer it. But, for some outsider, it seems like, that was an interesting choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the time there's logical reasons for the reorganization. Sometimes I do wonder whether, sometimes I think reorganizations are billed as solving more problems than they actually solve. So I'm a little cynical about reorganizations. But in the case of that particular one, while I thought it was engineering departments were awesome. I'm looking at Doug Gearing out there, former engineering dean. I think it did make a lot of sense to combine engineering programs on campus. So that reorganization, I would say, I think made a lot of sense rather than have mining and petroleum separated from other, having engineering together with ABET accreditation and all those processes. I think it was a pretty logical, and it made for, nice sized units, kind of more, good-sized units, and I think that one was logical, but sometimes.
I'm sure it's hit and miss.
I joked about saving old stationery because, you never know when that might come around again. I hate to throw all that stationery away because it might be useful.
Yeah, you think, oh my gosh. Well, and your friend and colleague, Susan Henricks, I had the opportunity to talk with her a while back, and she observed when she entered leadership that oftentimes you're motivated because there's an issue you want to see achieved, a goal maybe, or a problem that isn't being addressed that you think needs to be addressed. Mm-hmm. Was that your experience too?
I think that's probably one of the rewarding parts about it. I always really like to try to look and see how things were working and try to see if I could guide things a little bit so that they would maybe work a little bit better. I mean, my goal was always in an administrative position. And why I like Dean, I think, was because I do think I generally understand what faculty, what the challenges are and all to being faculty members. And I like to believe I was at least trying my best to not have administrative problems and stuff be in the way for people, that they could do their jobs, staff and faculty could do their jobs without having to worry about a bunch of stuff going on at the administrative level. And that was always kind of my goal, was to try to make things work so that people could do their jobs. And I'll really say that it really wasn't about me. I was, again, luck. I had, for the most part, I mean, there was a few exceptions and they generally moved on. But, you know, I mostly had fabulous people working for me. So if you can just get rid of the roadblocks and let fabulous people do their thing, then you look great. Yeah. Without really doing as much as you might imagine.
But it's really, you have to mentor them, right? I mean, yeah. And nurture. And
yeah. Students, for sure, yeah. But.
This is the other question, of course, with the university budget still in jeopardy, and finding the funds to keep your units running is a big part of that, right?
Yeah.
And you've worked in good times and bad. Is there some overall philosophy, except a good Chardonnay at the end of the day? Or?
I'd probably need the Magnum at the end of my days now. You know, I don't, even when I left CNSM and Paul Lehr was the dean a couple years later, we'd had quite a few budget cuts, and then, you know, he had had to endure many more budget cuts. And, you know, I remember telling him a couple years after he'd been dean, I said, I don't know what you're doing, because I thought I cut everything that you could possibly cut when I was there, you know. So, you know, one of the things I've seen over the years at the university is one person is now doing the job of three or four people. It's just not sustainable. I mean, stuff's got to give, and it's really tough. I don't have any really good advice except for that things are a real gem. UAF is a real gem. I did go outside to school for a while, and I was really worried because of all my training being here. When I was in master's program, I did all my coursework outside at Michigan State, which is where I met my husband, actually. But I was really worried when I went down there, because I thought, oh my gosh, you know, will I be able to compete? And I found that my training here was fabulous. So it's a long way of saying we have a real gem here, but you just can't keep cutting and cutting and cutting and keep it be a gem.
Yeah, well, I think that's axiomatic. That's right. Well, I do want to talk about how somebody who was in the sciences suddenly was tapped to be the head of UA Press. How did that come about?
Susan Henricks. Oh. Well, although I will say this, that was a really fun bit in my life. So I actually technically retired in 2009, which is what the little flyer said, but I really didn't stop working until 2016. So I was going to retire, and Susan knew that, and she needed somebody to be the press director because the person there was leaving, and she knew, because of budget cuts at the time, that it couldn't continue to be a full-time position, but she thought, and I agreed with her ultimately, that it could be a part-time position. And I thought, well, okay, I'm retiring, but maybe a part-time thing would be good. But it is a real change. I will say this, going back to the days when I was faculty, one year they had a graduation speaker who was a pop psychologist, really, but he was really entertaining. You know, sometimes graduation speakers, they're much more scholarly, but they're a lot more dreary. This guy was really entertaining. But one of the things he did is he had everybody take a 2-second personality quiz, and then he'd have people, you became either one color, I think there were four colors. You could either be one color or two colors, like a mix of two colors. But it was entertaining. He'd have you take this little test, and then he said, okay, everybody in, you know, the English department stand up, and they'd all stand up, and they'd all have the same color card. I mean, it was pretty remarkable. And what I do remember is everybody in sciences, maybe, or biology, I can't remember, sciences probably, stand up, and everybody's there with their green card, and there were two of us with our green card and our blue card or something. I can't remember what the other color was. And the other one was for art. Or humanities. And so I guess I always had that little thing. I don't know. At least the pop psychology test said so. But I really, really enjoyed that time. I was at the press actually for 6 years. And I really did enjoy, I met a whole different group of people across the state, got to meet writers across the state and interact with humanists. It was really good, led to being on the Alaska Humanities Forum board. the state board, which was really fun and interesting. And I served with somebody in the audience on that board, actually. Anyway, so it turned out to be a really good experience. And I think really largely my skill set there, and it was the right skill set for the director. The director is the person who manages the budget, builds team approach with the staff, gets the processes functioning, advocates for the unit. You know, the technical skills, the people there had the technical skills. And in fact, it was interesting because they were going to recruit again, and the list of preliminary questions they're asking, you know, have you ever designed a book? Have you ever done this? And I'm like, no, those aren't the skills you're looking for in a director. You want to know who's been able to advocate for something, who's been able to, you know, build teams of people that work well together, who's managed, done good with managing a budget. Those are really the skill set you need. And that was really the same skill set when it comes right down to it, to other management positions. So even though it seems weird, it wasn't as much of a transition. Because again, I had great people, the technical skills were there. I didn't have to know how to design a book.
Well, and UA Press has a wide range of subjects that it publishes in.
True.
So there's science and there's more literary and artistic ventures. Yep. So it must have been fun.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with Dr. Joan Braddock, former UAF administrator, researcher, and student. When we return from the break, Women in Science and Leadership. Listening to Northern Soundings, I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of the show is made possible by listeners like you in support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This summer, I'm airing recorded discussions I host as part of UAF Summer Sessions. It's called Down Memory Lane. This week, I'm speaking with former dean and professor, Dr. Joan Braddock. Let's return to our conversation.
Well, before we move on to retirement, how are we doing with women in science and women in leadership?
Yeah, well, it is something I have kind of tracked with time, because when I joined the biology department, there were, I don't know, around 27 men and me. It was the first time I'd really noticed, because in graduate school there were women, and I hadn't really thought about that. Certainly there were lots of articles about the lack of women in STEM and that sort of thing, but I hadn't, you know, when you're a student, you're just doing your thing, you're not paying too much attention to those things. And until you kind of go to the first faculty meeting, you look around and go, wow. So I had a joint appointment with the Institute of Arctic Biology and the Biology and Wildlife Department. So in IEB, I will say there was one other woman, but nevertheless, we were pretty scarce. So I've really tracked that with time at the university, and I meant to look that up, actually, and I didn't. About a year ago, I looked to see how many, but there's lots of women faculty. It's almost parity, I think, in the department now. It's close. You know, I think, and it's been up again and down again with leadership. There's sometimes several of the deans have been women, and sometimes there haven't been women. You know, I taught a course years ago called Women in Science, and it was interesting because a lot of students took it thinking it was sort of a history class, you know, how it used to be in the old days. And I'm like, no. I mean, the fact of the matter is, if you look globally, women still don't get paid the same a lot. It's common.
Yeah.
I certainly didn't. I mean, I was not in a good position, and that was actually corrected later. But I was, when I had been faculty for about 6 years, I was encouraged by several people who knew more about the faculty pay scales than I did, because I didn't pay too much attention to those things, to, you know, ask for an adjustment, because really I was like the only woman and the poorest paid person in the department. It didn't look very good on paper.
No, it sure didn't.
And
yeah.
I don't know whether it was overt exactly how that came to pass, but I wasn't a very good negotiator for one thing, because a lot of times women aren't taught to do that. So it's still an issue. I think it's improving, but I'm really encouraged when I see more women in STEM and seeing more women in the science departments here. When I was CNSM dean, we were under better times, particularly because there were big infrastructure. There was a lot of investment by federal programs, science, NIH, and NSF, that led to faculty hires because of matching to federal funds. And so during the time I was dean of CNSM, I was in the very pleasant position of hiring quite a few faculty, and I was really pleased that we hired quite a few women during that time. So,
well, it's interesting. I'll make a little plug here for KUAC on Science Friday last week. It was interesting. Gender bias even goes to the lab animals. Apparently, female mice are not as sought after. If I were a lab animal, I'd say, that's good. Yeah, I'm good with that. Yeah. You go right ahead.
Well, I mean, there's been studies, you know, they repeat these studies every so often, but it wasn't long ago there was another study on, you know, names on publications and things. If it's a male name versus a female name on the same exact proposal or publication, or hiring, there's been ones on hiring a female name on the same application as a male name, and the male getting the job. And I will say, to make men in the audience feel a little bit better, even if the boss is a woman, sometimes who's hiring, the male gets rated higher. That one study, that was really interesting. It wasn't just the, you know, men looking for at an application, it was women looking at the applications too, which was sort of too bad, I think. So,
well, let's transition to your real retirement, not that pseudo thing that happened for 6 years. And I want to say that many people in the audience may know this, or they might be surprised you're still connected with the campus in an important way, because weekly, you and your former colleagues, Susan Sugai and Susan Hendricks, will get together and trashercise, which, catchy little marketing phrase there, but it's really patrolling the campus looking for litter and picking it up.
Yep.
There are not a lot of leaders, but I mean, I'm thinking that's remarkable.
Yeah.
And how many calories? You have a little gal. That's the biggest tryer I've lifted yet.
I don't know how many calories we burned, but I think it'll tell you something about the personalities of the three people involved. So when a life event happened in Susan Hendricks' life several years back, Susan Sugai and I got together and said, well, maybe we could do something with Susan once a week, kind of get her out of her office. So I said, yeah, let's go out to lunch. I pictured a nice restaurant, white tablecloths. Sugai said, maybe we could go for a walk. So we suggested these things to Susan Hendricks, who thought it was a good idea. And she said, well, I kind of like the walk idea, but as long as we're going to be out there walking around, we might as well pick up trash while we're at it. So Trashercise was born.
Well, I think that's commendable, but I know you're a very enthusiastic outdoors person. Monday nights, can you frequently be ski walking up Hester Dome? So what are you engaged in now that you're retired?
Yeah, we do quite a bit of, we go down to Oregon for about 4 months in the winter. We volunteer at Mount Bachelor Ski Area as mountain hosts, which is a lot of fun. Not the responsibility of a ski patroller, but we get a lift pass for that and some other benefits. And so we do quite a bit of skiing. We do quite a bit of hiking. We just came back from hiking Chena Dome. Wow. And I met somebody in the audience here today on the hike from Chena Dome, found out I knew her husband. So we try to do quite a bit of hiking and outdoor things. We've been really lucky. Well, there's that luck again, right? To stay healthy enough to stay active. So we do a lot of those kinds of things.
And it's so interesting. You have this lifelong connection with this community, and there must be something nurturing and supportive in that long association.
Yeah, I don't have hardly any family. I mean, I kind of did because my parents came from big families, but so many of them have passed away, and I grew up here, so I didn't know family members. So really friends and friends of family members are really my network of support, and Fairbanks is really special because of that, and I actually should say thank you to, I have lots of friendly faces out there tonight, and I appreciate you taking an hour out of a beautiful summer evening to come tonight. So that support is wonderful.
Yeah. Well, usually what I do is open it to any questions because so many of your friends here have the real story. And when you ask your question, because I'm recording it, I'll repeat your questions so it can be heard maybe for the whole audience and for the radio program. So does anybody have any questions for Joan? So before you answer, let me just repeat your question is what the recovery state of Prince William Sound is now, as opposed from when you were studying it.
You know, I'm probably not the very best person to answer that question, just because we had such a narrow focus with our studies. And I think some things have recovered quite well. I know it wasn't so long ago that I still think you could have found places where there was pockets of oil and such. I think most organisms have recovered okay, but you know, you certainly can't take too many hits like that to an environment and completely recover. I'm definitely not the best person to say in a global sense. You know, there was quite a bit of dilution. There was quite a lot of microbial degradation. There were other factors, photo degradation and other factors that, you know, got rid of a lot of the oil. But, you know, I think it's recovered reasonably well, but I know there's still things that are different than they would have been if the spill hadn't occurred.
So are microorganisms recovering well? She heard that it was the steam cleaning.
Yeah, we never in our studies, we looked at other treatments, but we didn't actually look at steam cleaning. Yeah, I wasn't so sure about some of those mechanical processes that were done, but I don't really have a good definitive, you know, scientific answer. Because we didn't specifically look at steam cleaned beaches. That wasn't one of the treatments.
Okay, so your arts contribution before UA Press.
Yes, I worked for Michelle Bartlett a long time ago doing, I earned my way partly through college. So when I was in high school, I actually did a lot of art stuff and I was on the art staff, which was literally the only cool thing I did in high school. But the art staff did all the banners and posters for plays and all that kind of stuff. And when I came up to go to college, those skills, I pretty much had to earn my way through college. And back in the day, you kind of could, you know. I mean, now it'd be pretty impossible, I think, to really earn your way through college. But back in the day, you could. And one of my jobs for quite a while, actually, was working for Michelle. And I did all the kind of those big banners and posters that hang in Wood Center for events and things like that. Oh, and another thing, I did calligraphy quite well. So I would do, before computers, you could hand all the certificates and stuff could be hand calligraphed, and I would make certificates for things. Paint signs, and around town there used to be still a few signs hanging around town that I had painted, and actually another sweet story about that really quickly is that my mom was one of 12 children, and her father believed in education for boys, and so the six boys went to school, but she was the only girl that did. And her mother's only source of disposable income was she raised chickens and had eggs that she sold. And so she would send my mother her egg money. And my mother, because my dad believed so much, I was an only child, but that my dad was a firm believer that I needed to earn my way through college. So I always worked summers and during the school year. And my mom's only real source of her own income was Social Security checks. And my mom actually signed over her Social Security checks to me every month to help support college. And she would call that her egg money. It's almost bringing tears to my eyes.
Well, I want to thank you, Dr. Joan Braddock, for spending time with us this evening.
Well, thank you, Robert.
A link to UAF Summer Sessions is on the Northern Soundings website. My thanks to Michelle Bartlett and Summer Sessions for permission to air the discussions. That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. We'll see you next week when I talk with linguist and native language champion Dr. Larry Kaplan. Thanks for listening.